Welcome to Side by Side, a podcast where I, Robert Kwong, take you inside conversations with artists, creatives, healers, and warriors taking the charge in their transformational story. Today's guest is Richard Dixie, the author of 3 Minutes a Day, a 14-week course to learn meditation and transform your life, who's also a senior faculty member at Dharma College in Berkeley, California. A research scientist and a lifelong student of Buddhism who holds advanced degrees in biophysics and the history and philosophy of science, Mr. Dixie directed a bioelectric research unit at a London hospital before becoming CEO of his own biotech company. He moved to the United States in 2007 to devote himself to teaching meditation, deepening his own practice, and running the Light of Buddha Dharma Foundation in India with his wife, Wangmo, the eldest daughter of the well-known Tibetan Lama, Tartan Toku. In this conversation, we dive into the fundamentals of meditation, the relationship between science and mysticism, and the value of meditation practice with contemporary living, 3 minutes at a time. First of all, thank you so much for this book and the completion of this book. I've been reading it, and it's a 14-week journey, and I'm currently on week 3. So you're catching myself at a kind of a self-pace as I receive the manuscript. So thank you for that. It's been so helpful, even for me. So yeah, thank you.
Wow. Okay. That's really wonderful to hear. Are you a meditator yourself?
I am, but I definitely consider myself to be a beginner because I was more of a dabbler. And so I've tried different structures. And when I started reading the book initially for our conversation, I couldn't help but to practice. After all, the title is 3 Minutes a Day, a 14-week course to learn meditation and transform your life. 3 minutes a day is not a terribly huge ask after all, you know?
Wonderful. And you find it's working? Is it working? Are you getting a result that you like?
Yes. And I'm happy to go into maybe just my personal experience as we continue our conversation. That might be, and I'm a pianist and a musician myself. So certain specific ways of practice has really resonated with me. So thank you, Richard, for that. And I'm curious, how are you doing leading up to this book launch?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm a teacher at a Buddhist college called Dharma College. And, you know, so I teach classes all the time. And this book came out of classes, actually. We were teaching at Dharma College. So, you know, in some respects, it's just part of what I normally do. Kind of interesting.
Yeah. Well, I definitely know how deliberate it is to title the book and to create this journey for 3 minutes a day. And I think, you know, it might be surprising to some people when they picture, let's say they've never attempted meditation before, they might have the imagery of someone sitting there for long durations of time. And maybe the aim is to develop a longer and longer capacity to sit on a cushion, perhaps. So what made you decide to introduce meditation in just 3 minutes a day?
Okay, this really, it's a good, very, very good question. And it leads into what meditation is for. And I think this is where a lot of misconceptions have happened with regard to meditation. So, you know, meditation is part of a great Asian wisdom tradition. Of course, every culture had a wisdom tradition going back into antiquity. But most of the contemporary cultures of the West, those wisdom traditions are broken. And so we don't have a direct link to what happened in medieval Europe or for example. But in Asia, they're not. And particularly the Buddhist traditions are literally unbroken and go back 2,500 years at least, if not more. Mm. And they represent something deeply, deeply interesting to modernity. And this has to do with perception. Now, we're taught in school in contemporary culture that the real world is outside us. You know, black holes, quasars, you know, laws of science, etc. As if we are in a real thing and we are just an onlooker to that real thing. Now, this is a very, very problematic position. because our only experience is personal. The only thing we can ever experience are what comes through our five senses and our mind, emotions, and imaginations. There is nothing else we can actually experience. So the real world is actually that. We, using those inputs, infer a cosmos, a world outside of us, by inference. But we don't directly experience it. We only directly experience the inputs from our five senses and our mind and imaginations. So meditation, when you actually boil it down, is how can I look at those inputs themselves, rather than using them to infer the existence of a world outside me? Why don't I look at them themselves? Now, this is a life skill. Honestly, it should be taught along with reading and writing in primary school, because we color, we influence, the proper word is we condition what we receive through our senses and what we imagine and think. We preconceive in those data streams ideas, opinions, judgments, worries, concerns, which we then project as, quote, the real world, and consequently land up in states of profound stress. We often make very bad decisions. We land up confused because we're not clearly understanding the difference between our direct experience, which are the five senses and the mind, and what we infer from them, which is everything else. Now, this is a fundamental life skill, as I said. And meditation has come down to us in these ancient traditions, largely through the practices of monks, mainly Buddhist monks, but not entirely. There are meditation traditions in other religious systems as well. And these people are full-time religious workers, divines. So for them, meditating an hour or 2 hours or whatever is part of a day's work. I mean, it's what they do, right? But of course, if you're living in contemporary culture and you're not a monk, then it's suddenly a very different prospect. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be sitting for hours at a time. A, you don't have the time. And B, why would you anyway? What would be the purpose of doing that? Now, that's what triggered this inquiry. Can you approach the question of looking at your experience as experience, not using your experience to make statements about anything else, looking at your experience as experience in a very short period? And the answer is you can. Because like any skill, the key is to be deliberate, to do something that's effective, and do it every day. And if you do that, whether it's playing the piano, playing the violin, playing golf, it doesn't matter what it is, you will eventually develop a skill base. So in teaching this to classes, I began to realize there really was quite a general approach here. And that's what turned into the book. And what this book is designed to do, it's based on a contract that I make with the reader. I say to the reader, look, all I want you to do is meditate 3 minutes a day. Just tell me you'll do that. And it takes to drink a cup of coffee. And what I will do is I will explain exactly what it is that you're doing and why. And I won't use a bunch of technical language, which doesn't really make a lot of sense. There'll be no religious, you know, paraphernalia on top. It'll simply address perception directly. And the promise is you do that 3 minutes a day for 14 weeks. I'll give you a series of progressive exercises, which I will explain. And by the end of the 14 weeks, you'll have access to your own experience as experience in a reliable manner. That has enormous consequences in terms of well-being, emotional resilience, in terms of creativity, in terms of making sense of our experience generally, in terms of making better decisions, being better balanced. I mean, all kinds of really, really fundamental benefits. And it's surprisingly easy to do. Now, obviously, if you want to go on from there and develop special mental skills, as a monk might, then you might want to extend your meditation and sit for an hour or whatever, you want to do. That's fine. Mm-hmm. But there's no necessity to do that, to get the fundamental benefit of meditation, which is finally to know what your actual experience is. Because the actuality of your experience is always going to be one of the five sense gates, or the mind and imaginations. There is nothing else we can experience. And this initially is a bit of a surprise to people who've been educated in a scientific manner. They always say, what about all the laws of science, etc.? They are not direct experiences. They're inferences that we draw from direct experience. But ultimately, all we can actually directly experience are the five senses and the mind. So getting to bring those six gates, those six streams into conscious relation with ourselves is surely got to be one of the main things you should do as you grow up as a human being. But amazingly, it's not. And as a result, people are often profoundly confused about what is real, what is true, even who they are. They're just deeply, deeply confused. And all of these things are addressed by a simple meditation practice.
And you're not saying that lightly because of your background. I note that you hold advanced degrees in things like biophysics and the history of and philosophy of science. And in many ways that has...
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, influenced your curiosity into some might call it mysticism, but things like meditation, and encouraged your travel to India and Asia. You write a little bit about that in the introduction of the book, but what was that journey like going from a, let's say, a Western culture way of perceiving and experiencing and starting to look at a different way of being entirely, your personal experience? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a bit older than you. So I come from I graduated college in 1972, and my youth was in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And at that time, it was the age of big science. So, you know, we discovered the genetic code, you know, there were major discoveries in quantum physics and, you know, 2001, A Space Odyssey and all that. You know, we were really finding the truth. I remember that wonderful thing in 2001 where this thing that looks like a sort of cigarette packet turns up all the time, mm-hmm. lands up in front. And so I really thought that science was discovering the truth. Now, when I went to university, it began to dawn on me this wasn't the case. There were all kinds of elements of human behavior and experience that weren't anything to do with scientific analysis. I had a kind of crisis. Mm. I remember sitting with my dean at Oxford, and he said to me, Dixie, within 200 years, science will have explained everything. And I remember looking at him and thinking, you're just so stupid. How can you make that statement? Obviously, science isn't going to explain everything. There are tons of features in human life which are never going to be explained by science. It's a ridiculous statement. And that took me to India, because I realized that the Asian tradition, I had an intuition that somehow over there I was going to make contact with another way of knowing that was different. And indeed I did. I had an incredible year in India. I took a year off my college. When I came back, I realized that really there was something else that was equally important. However, there is a problem. The problem is, if you get interested in what you could call the esoteric or the occult, or whatever you want to call it, these other things, there's no basis to make true statements within them. There's a lot of fantasy, frankly, in what people have on their spiritual bookshelves, because there's no systematic structure behind. There probably was in the ancient times, but those lineages are broken. So now people write books, they make stuff up basically and say it's what I think. Well, I actually landed up working as a research scientist and began to address some interesting questions about what is real. And during that period, towards the end of it, I reconnected with the Asian meditation traditions. And realized, wow, those traditions are both personal, like the esoteric and the occult, but are systematic. They're designed to systematically explore personal experience.
Mm.
So you could say they're a bit like science. They're not scientific. They're a bit like science because they are structured and they are carefully structured and they complete the picture. So suddenly then you have inferential statements about, quote, external reality and a really properly structured internal experience based in your meditative insight. That to me is the whole that Western culture desperately, desperately needs. Because what's happening now, as we go through rapid social change, rapid environmental change, rapid technological change, is because people are cognitively naive about their own experience, they're grasping at straws. They're desperately seeking conspiracy theories and all kinds of weird nonsense because they have not got a base in their own experience. And it's leading to very, very dangerous behavior. We're seeing political crisis happening literally alongside the technological development of devices which directly address our experience. These mobile phones full of, you know, social media are directly designed to address our experience. And unless we have some understanding of how we generate our understanding of the world, we are literally victims of manipulation. And this has been a real feature of the last 20 years. And this is going to be solved only when there is a systematic engagement with meditation. Now, meditation is not to be 10% happier. You will be 10% happier. You'll be a lot more than 10% happier. But that's not what it's for. It's not even to live a good life, although you will live a good life. What it's for is to understand who you are. And in our current circumstance, with all of this change, this could not be more important. And as I said, the surprising thing is, as a skill, it is quite easy to generate. It doesn't require enormous effort. And in generating it, you will address all these other things. They come along with it. And that's the backdrop. So, you know, although it's a kind of, you know, 3 minutes a day, you know, bit jokey kind of thing, you know, actually behind it's really quite a serious message. I think we're in a cultural crisis. I think modernity is extremely alarming. And if we don't get to grips with how we generate a world map by which we live, if we don't get to grips with that process and understand it better, really we're going to go through some very difficult times. And you can see it everywhere you look. There's this feeling of societal breakdown. And this is addressed directly by being able to see your experience as experience and finally find out who you are in all of this. And of course, we're not some irrelevant onlooker to a, quote, real world. We are the real world. Everything else is something we have inferred about the circumstances we're in. And so, of course, this brings with it a great growth of emotional resilience. We land up able to deal with problems more effectively, and we can take control in a very real sense of our experience. And boy, all of those things are good things to get for 3 minutes a day.
Absolutely. My first experience of starting to basically follow the process and the pacing of the book itself, my immediate thought was, of course, this could be easily introduced in a fourth grade classroom or right before a music lesson or right before some physical training. In fact, there's a line in your book, you say, you could say in meditation, we're trying to become accomplished athletes or skilled artisans of our own perception. You know, the way my brain kind of jumped was, wow. I've often said this since I've started, you know, mostly just dabbling in meditation, but I wish I had some of that foundations as I was learning piano as the instrument. And now I am sort of integrating it myself and my own pacing of sorts. But this has been an incredible resource, so thank you.
Well, I mean, the other thing to say, it's really interesting here. I use music metaphor a lot.
Yes.
Because people's hunger for direct experience and for non-verbal experience is so great that now we worship actors sportsman, any performer. And it's very interesting, if you go to a concert and you hear a great performer, of course, they have practiced their scales and they practiced and practiced and practiced. But to be a great performer, you break free of all that training into some new state. And that new state is a state of innate performance, which is quite tangible to the onlookers. And after a great performance, as you know, at the end of it, everybody's just hanging there in this experience. That is really important. And that state is a state we can all access. That state is given to us. We don't have to go to a concert to get that state. We could get that state anytime once we learn how we are with respect to the six gates of experience.
So in looking at the six gates, five of them are related to our five senses, correct? So people who have never looked at meditation before might be surprised to hear that it is often recommended to keep your eyes open during meditation practice. Could you quickly explain why that might be recommended?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the six gates, you know, the problem, what is the human condition is this? The world existed before we were born. And the only reason we know that is when we are born and we open our eyes, it's already there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not there for us, but there is something there already, right? Your mom and dad and the crib and everything. So we're born into something, but we don't have an instruction manual. We've got no book that says, okay, you've got six senses and this is what you've got to do and all the rest of it. We have to make it up as we go along. And unfortunately, what happens is in that making up process, which we call growing up, all kinds of random and accidental things happen to us, all get piled in to the little instruction manual we make for ourselves, which we then live by. And as a result, our experience is being colored by all kinds of influences we don't understand, because they were put in to this instruction manual we've made for ourselves while we were growing up. And often we can't even access them properly. Now, the six senses, the five senses in the mind, the six gates that come towards us are normally active at the same time, all the time. So the problem we have is we're being bombarded by inputs. Now, technically speaking, our attention is being adverted to one gate or another, depending on what we think is important. Now, normally, that's a protective mechanism. We generate an idea of ourselves in the world, and we are adverted to threat, whether the threat is physical threat, or whether the threat is emotional threat, or perhaps environmental threat, or societal threat, whatever it is, which is why all news is bad news, because we develop a world map based on protecting ourselves and doing the best job we can. Now, this is normally completely unconscious within us. So most meditation techniques begin by simplifying those six gates to one gate. And the reason for that is it's very, very complicated to work with six gates. So normally, in the classic way meditation is taught in most of the ancient traditions that have come to us in the West, is we look at the sense of touch as the nose on the nose, as the breath goes in and out of our nose as we breathe, during our normal experience of breathing. And this is called, rather confusingly, Vipassana meditation. I'll explain why in a moment. But anyway, that's what people think meditation is. No, meditation is any one of those six gates. But what you do is take one of them and look at it carefully. So I start off chapter one, as you know, looking at a candle. And the reason is it's a visual gate. So we're looking at an image. But we're looking at a real thing. This is a candle now. And we're looking at the candle flame and working out how it's moving and how it's changing. We're just looking at it. We're learning to advert our attention. It's where the word advertising comes from. It means we move our attention to a chosen object. Now, in the old traditions, this is called vitaka, the ability to move attention deliberately. But one of the great keys is this. Our clarity of mind can literally be likened to a glass of water with some chalk in it. If we're being adverted all the time with our attention being dragged this way and that by all the inputs that are coming to us, that water is being stirred up all the time and it's cloudy and we can't make good decisions. We can't see clearly. We're feeling stressed. What we have to learn to do is to calm down by simply taking one of the sense gates and watching it. And what happens is the water begins to settle. Now, that settling process is called shamatha, and it literally means calmness meditation. And just like when the water settles, the water becomes clear. So as we settle our own internal state, we see clearly. V is clearly, and C is vipassana. Vipassana, clear seeing. It's a fruit of calmness. So as we calm, we land up seeing more clearly. Now, this is where we get to something interesting. Adverting is brittle. That's to say, we advert to one thing and then something comes along and we advert to that. We advert to this and we advert to that. So most meditators, when they begin meditating, find themselves very easily distracted by sounds outside them, or suddenly a thought comes along and they're distracted to that. They're being distracted this way and that. How do we overcome that brittleness? And this is where we begin a very interesting analysis that's there in the old traditions and is fascinating. Actually, concentration, the ability to concentrate on a chosen object, has two features, not one. The first is adverting, which is literally to move your attention to that thing. And the second is to savor that thing, to stay with it. And technically speaking, the first one's called vitakka, and the second one's called vikara. Now, vikara is not brittle. It's literally like you pick up a cup of coffee, put it to your lips. That's adverting your attention, vitakka. Then you drink the coffee and taste it. That's vikara. Now, that ability to savor is intensely important, because if you learn to savor experience, you are no longer brittle. Because when something comes along that's not part of that savoring, you just incorporate it as another flavor. So what we do as we go through the early weeks in the 14-week process is move from a simple object of concentration to an object that changes in time. And the one I like to use is a fading bell, which is using the ear gate. Again, we sit and literally just listen. We don't do anything else. And then as the sound fades, as we hit a bell, that's vitakka. As it fades, that's vikara. We follow the fading sound until eventually there's total silence. And we can find ourselves concentrated, savoring nothing, just concentrated. Now, in that state, as that stabilizes, we find ourselves able to access calmness without an object. Now, this is where it gets interesting. So normally we do these with our eyes closed. And the reason is because the eye gate's very dominant. We are predators. We have binocular vision. We're designed to see things clearly. So people normally close their eyes. But as you begin to develop vikara to the point where you're stable, you can open your eyes. And you can choose whether you're going to react to something or not. Now, this is an important development in meditation, because where meditation really matters is in everyday life. If your meditation is only something you do sitting on a cushion in front of a shrine with your eyes closed, it's not going to be a whole bunch of use to you the moment you get up and do anything else. This is very, very problematic. And so really learning to meditate with the eyes open is a big moment where meditation suddenly leaves the special environment of a shrine room and becomes something you can use in a coffee shop, in your place of work, whatever you're doing. You can always access that calmness. Once you've accessed that calmness, you can start asking questions about your experience, which are otherwise unavailable to you, because you're never able to see your experience as experience. And if you can't see your experience as experience, how can you ask questions about it? So it opens a door to a way of being, literally a new way of being. I think it genuinely is. The word on the cover is transform. Actually, really like the word transform because you're not changing anything. What you're doing is really seeing what's there. It's there all along. What transforms is your behavior. Your behavior transforms because you're finally seeing what was there all along. You're seeing the actuality of your experience. And in that calm clarity that comes when you're no longer reacting subconsciously, what I call reflexive reactivity, you're no longer reflexively bouncing off one thing or another. You gradually can ask questions about what you really want, what your real circumstance is, what really matters, and suddenly you'll get answers, which are otherwise just lost in all the noise and stress and stuff that goes on.
Well, as a musician, I looked at the concept of vakara and I was so grateful for having a word that conveyed something that musicians and performers are always looking for, this North Star of, you've described it, being in the zone, being able to savor, versus so many musicians,
Exactly.
so many friends I know would say, I performed and I don't remember a thing. I completely blacked out. They were, they were unable to experience it,
Exactly.
basically. And so even when I was,
There is a misunderstanding you've introduced here, which is important. Now, why does the performer not remember their performance at the Met? Why is that? What's happened is they've broken free of their map of the world into an actual experience. At the time, they were totally present in that experience. Now, this is a deep, deep secret. Our memory, our ability to remember, requires geotags, file cabinet entries. One is I. And the other is there, wherever it is, the place, the thing. I was playing the piano at the Metropolitan Opera. However, if you break free of the map into the playing of the piano at the Metropolitan Opera, there's no map. There's no map reference. You can't remember it. It doesn't mean it wasn't happening. It's just your memory has deceived you. We always remember the past tense. Now, this is a real, real secret. This is called the Maya of time. We remember in the past tense because in the present, we are not there. There is stuff happening, but there's no me doing it. People write books about the ego. As if it's something in the world. It is not. It's a filing reference for the Maya of memory. This is a deep, deep secret. And it's why we are so confused, because we remember ourselves as being separate from our actions. But actually, we are our actions. There isn't someone else pulling the strings. We are our actions. So when you play the piano in the Met and you're totally playing the piano, you are totally one with the performance. That's why people love to hear it, because they can feel this magical unification. Again, it comes from being a meditator. That's exactly what is happening. The performer is moving into a state of profound unity, meditative unity. That's why it's so beautiful. But that's why they can't remember it. So there's a misunderstanding that sometimes occur, particularly with this term mindfulness, very problematic word, because it's not actually mindfulness at all. It's really remembering is what it is. Anyway, so this word mindfulness, the idea is somehow we are going to be present at all times. But as I've just said, we are a map reference. We can't be present at all times because we are merely a filing reference. There can be presence at all times, but we won't be there because we were never there in the first place. All we were was a geotag, a file locator that enabled our memory to place us there in the process of recollection. That's all it is. There's the enigma of the ego. And that's why it's called a Maya. It's an illusion. It's profoundly important recognition of our actual circumstance. So when you watch a great performer, a great athlete, it doesn't matter. It's anyone who's up against a performative act. As they enter unification and totally do it, where they're playing baseball, tennis, performing a musical instrument, an actor, it doesn't matter what it is, they enter a state of unification where they are one with their performance. That is totally enthralling for an audience. It's just so enthralling to see it. People are locked in because they are there too. And they have that blissful feeling of no longer being in a map of reality, but being actually in reality.
Yes.
Will they remember it? No, they won't, because their memory will never access it. And this is, again, a profound teaching about meditation. Because why are we so worn out? Why are we so stressed? It's because we're living in a model of our lives. We're not living in our lives. And as long as we think the model is real, we're always going to feel a sense of being disconnected somehow
yes.
from what's really happening.
Yes.
We literally are. So meditation is not about abiding in some calm place where I can watch the world. That's a total misunderstanding. Meditation is about being in the world totally. There's no I there. To do that, we have to understand the sixth gate. And gradually as we do so, we can learn to stop the world. And what I mean by that is we stop the map. And as we look around, we realize, wow, there's a whole world here that's not part of the map. It's something else. This is the big discovery that meditation offers. Wow. It's totally magical.
Again, this could easily be a masterclass for music students, you know, as opposed to when I went through conservatory and I'm classically trained, so there's that tradition, you know, listening to an idea and practicing meditation versus trying to get there through practicing 6 hours a day and whatnot, right? The grueling.
Of course, you need both is the answer. Let's be clear. There's a wonderful story about a famous golfer called Jack Nicklaus. You probably know this guy. He was a famous golfer. He's retired now. He used to hit holes in one the whole time. And it's always called a lucky shot. And he did this quite regularly. And once a journalist said, "Mr. Nicklaus, why are you so lucky?" And he said, "Son, the more I practice, the luckier I get." Interesting. The more I practice, the luckier I get.
Yes.
Now, again, of course, you've got to learn to play the piano. In meditation, we have to learn to look at the six gates. It's a skill. Then, with that skill, it opens the door to transcend the skill into true performance. There's always a process of learning that then needs to be transformed. And of course, we all know Glenn Gould playing the Goldberg variations, and there he is humming as he's playing, you know, that recording. He's humming because he's totally in the performance. He's totally lost any conception of recording anything. He's just playing and humming as he goes along. It's the most wonderful experience of freedom. And people always say, "I want freedom. I want to be free. I want to be free of all my worries." This is it. When you are truly engaged with whatever you're doing, you are truly free. Because suddenly there isn't a plan. There isn't any idea of what you're doing. You are in what you're doing. You are cognitively free. And this is the fulfillment of our human potentiality. This is truly who we are. We do amazing. Human beings are the most extraordinary animals. And of course, the reason is that we have this faculty that can learn from experience and apply that learning to our current circumstances. That's the map making. But the map making in the end acts as a prison. Having made our map, we then need to be able to become free of it so it can advise and inform us, but not precede us like the walls of a prison. And so as we learn to do that, we can learn to drop the map and enter experience. And then what the map represents is an advisor saying this will work, that will work, we land up making good decisions because suddenly we are wise. Furthermore, we are patient. We're no longer in some hurry. We're not being pushed this way and that because our reactivity is unconscious. So this is the great benefit that can come once we take control at this fundamental level.
It is so incredibly moving hearing you convey these concepts in some ways. So thank you. In doing the practice myself, I sometimes have found that I had a couple of reactions to it. One was I wanted to go for longer. And in fact, in the book, you recommend, please, you know, make it deliberate to be 3 minutes. And in addition, I also found myself at times, if thoughts and feelings arise, that I wanted to journal after the 3 minute practice. I'm curious what your thoughts are about these type of practices.
One of the other things that gets introduced relatively early are called the obstacles to yes. meditation, the five nivarana, the old term. And these are very simple. They occur, honestly, these were written down 2,500 years ago and it's still happening now. These are fundamental to human nature. These are things that arise as we begin to leave the map behind, this cognitive structure that we create for ourselves, we call the world. Now, there are five of them. They're in two pairs and a single one. The two pairs are agitation and dullness, attraction and aversion, it's the second pair, and doubt makes five. Those are the five nivaranas. Now, one of the classics is attraction. I want this. Let me say, I want to be free. I want to understand. So, of course, one of the things I say is, look, while you're doing your 3 minutes, just for this course of the book, don't give in to that nivarana. The reason is, if you say, well, I'm going to meditate for an hour now, I'm a really good meditator, you're no longer meditating. You're then in the idea of meditating for an hour. And this is what happens to people when they try to follow instructions. Often they land up in a thought of what they're doing, rather than like Glenn Gould, having no idea what they're doing. They're just in it. We want to be just in it. So to me, the perfect meditation is one where at the end of it, you don't know if it was good, you don't know if it was bad, you don't even know really what you were doing, you just did it. That's it, that's the perfect meditation. That is the one that's going to accumulate like a dripping tap into a faculty that you can access at any time, which is calm and clear. It doesn't have any agenda. It doesn't have any of those five nivaranas in it. So my advice there would be stick to the 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Of course, if you really find it's going well and you know you are just by all means extend it, but don't make it something you want to do, because that's one of the nivaranas coming in and trying to take control. Because obviously what our map maker will always try to do is say, oh, I see, you're meditating. Now, I can help you. I've read all these books. I can help you. That's what he's always going to want to say to you. I can make it better for you. No. I don't need your help. I'm going beyond your help. I don't need you to help me. This is the thing about meditation. Meditation ultimately must be beyond instruction. Just like a great pianist must go beyond the scales and the music into the performance. It's the same thing. You've got to transcend the training completely. So my advice would be, as far as extending it goes, on the whole, resist that. Now, after you've done your 14 weeks, you might decide you want to meditate longer. That's great. Now, with journaling, it's slightly different. Journaling is a really interesting activity. And if you're able to journal objectively, that's to say you can write about your experience as experience, what the how of your experience, what actually happened, that can actually be quite useful, I think. And certainly journaling is part of a life lived more deeply. I'm not a journaler myself. So to me, I've never really developed that skill set. But if you have that skill set and can write about the how of what happens, not the why, it wasn't, oh, I meditated well today. You know, it was the how of the meditation.
Mm-hmm.
That can actually reinforce learnings and can be quite valuable.
Thank you. Thank you for that perspective. That was really helpful. Similarly, for people who are going through this 14-week journey, they might have the idea that they want to, let's say they've completed the 14-week journey, they would like to maybe find a community or maybe work with someone directly. Is there anything that you tend to encourage people to consider when they're, let's say, trying to find a group or is considering doing group practice?
There are two things to say. There are hundreds of meditation groups, meditation schools, meditation approaches. The problem for the newcomer to this very rich, complicated world is they have no idea what meditation is. So it's very hard for them to make a decent choice. Now, my hope, one of the minimal hopes I have with this book is at the end of the 14 weeks, they'll have an idea what meditation is. They'll be able to choose much more precisely what works for them and what doesn't, because they'll know what meditation is. So the first point is, just if you get to the end of the 14 weeks, you'll have a pretty good idea of what meditation is. Then you might be attracted by one approach or another. That's great. And you go ahead and do it. And when it stops working for you, you can leave. You don't feel like you failed, because in many ways, you are already a master. You may have only mastered 3 minutes a day, but you've nonetheless got a body of experience that you actually own, that is yours, and consequently you can use it to make good judgment. That's the first point. Obviously, I run a meditation school myself, Dharma College, dharma-college.com. It's on the back page of the book. And we offer lots and lots of classes about how we make the world. And I also offer meditation classes there. And so that might be a place people want to come. But there are many, many other communities too. And there are many, many other different styles. And the reason for this is that our map making limits our capacity to a very, very small percentage of what is possible. We land up being reactive against a very limited set of learned responses. As we become free of that reflexive reactivity, we find all kinds of capacities that we never knew we had. Now, we may decide to explore some of them. And in so doing, we might go off down one road or another, and that's going to be entirely personal. There isn't a path that I would recommend for everyone, because all of us have different capacities, different needs, and different structures within us. So what really this is about is opening a little chink where you go, I get what I'm doing now. Now, what works for me? And if Dharma College works for you, join us at Dharma College. If going off and studying in the Theravadan school works for you, go and do that. If you want to get into MBSR, go and do that. If you want to study with the Tibetans and do tantric meditation, go and do that. Whatever it is, or indeed, I've had many students who've gone back to the Christian contemplative tradition, which is another form of meditation, which is, you know, an attempt to recreate the old medieval meditations that used to happen in Christianity, or into other religious faiths that they have. There's no particular reason to stay within one tradition or another. The key is you don't lose that core of experience, which I hope this book will give. And if you find you're doing a meditation and it's not working, drop it. This is not religious. There's no obligation somewhere that you've got to do this. Meditation should always be about addressing your own experience as experience. You might want to introduce into your experience techniques or insights, which you then contemplate in meditation. You can do that. You can enhance what's happening to you deliberately. But nonetheless, having brought those things in, just like the piano player, you then have to engage in a relationship with them that goes entirely beyond any training. And so that's my advice. It may sound complicated. It's not really. It's just saying, I hope you'll land up living life better. Whatever it is you decide you want to do, whether you might want to be an artist, or you might find that, you know, you might find as a musician, it really helps you. You know, all of these different things are possible. Meditation really is a universal tool. It's not really designed to do one thing or another. It's designed to make sense and to give us the ability to make sense of our experience and ultimately to transcend it deliberately into something utterly magical, which you really could say is real, as appeared to inferred real. So when you are in a performance and you are totally there with your piano, there is an ineffable unity that is real. Now, it's real for you because you're doing it. Others can engage in it as an audience and also taste that reality. That is the magic that we all have just in front of us, if only we would access it.
Wow. Well, I want to respect your time. So I want to ask anything else you want to say about the book. But before I do, I'd like to read a section that I told myself I will print out and put in front of my keyboard, if I may. Meditation is learning to be effortless. So when a moment of distraction arises and we find ourselves flying away on our map maker's magic carpet, wheeling through scenario after scenario of desire, aversion, dullness, agitation, and doubt, we stop, we reapply vikara, and stay there. Our breath will not have gone anywhere. We learn not to fight with distractions because that fighting is another aspect of the magic carpet. It is totally pointless. Something about that just resonated with me, and you know, I have a little board in front of me, and I would like to put it up before I begin what I have often said is practice, but I would like to re-engage with practice once more. So that really resonated with me.
A really nice quote. You've written syncapsulate, those are the five nirvanas, and that's how you overcome them. Yeah, you don't fight them because they are fighting. That's the point. You merely re-engage. It's so interesting. And it's so simple. Really, it's so simple. You know, the only thing I'd say is as you go through 14 weeks, you'll find it engages more and more with actual experience. And although there are techniques, ultimately we are turning back toward a true center we've always had. There's a sense of coming home in a very real sense, I think. And again, if meditation brings that, if this small book would bring that about in people, that's really wonderful.
Yes.
Because that's really what it's about. Mm-hmm. I've created an app too, which is free and comes with the book. There's one of those installation code diagrams in the front page. And that enables you to put it on your phone so you can do it anytime in the day. Because again, I'm really wanting to move away from meditating in a class or meditating in some formal manner into something you just do anytime. And of course, there's no obligation to just do it once a day either. You can do it more than once a day. 3 minutes more than once a day is much better than 6 minutes once a day. 2-3 minutes is better than 1 6-minute, because it's the accessing of that state that is valuable. As we learn to access it more and more, so we find it as what in the traditions is called a refuge. We suddenly find, wow, I've always got this capacity. I don't have to be frazzled. I can just say, oh, okay, I'll go to my refuge. And that is a wonderful thing to find in yourself. So I'm super delighted that you're finding this book helpful. And it's so interesting you're a musician, because in many ways, meditation is the key to the art of living. The French have a wonderful phrase. They say to be good in your own skin. And meditation helps you be good in your own skin. And often contemporary people aren't. They feel alienated from their own skin. They may be very effective. They may be able to concentrate very well and achieve many things, but they're never relaxed. They're always like having to kind of adjust all the time. And that's because they've been disconnected in a very fundamental way from their actuality. As you become good in your own skin, so you find yourself able to be clear about what really matters and what really doesn't. And again, that discrimination is so valuable, because we're surrounded by this smorgasbord of opportunities which are growing all the time as technological progress happens. We're literally surrounded. And so many of these things have no value. They take our time and they make us do things that really we shouldn't be doing. And so having the capacity to rest calm and clear is the great fruit. And it's not a religious thing. It's just a life skill to be good in your own skin. So I'm delighted. And of course, I play the guitar and
Oh, wonderful.
I know very well about music. Yeah, it's the same thing. When you play a musical instrument and you find yourself playing it nicely, somehow there's something so beautiful about that relationship. It's full in itself. It doesn't need anything else. It's a full relationship already. And all I'm saying is all of our senses can offer this. Any sense, anything, ultimately, the most valuable of them all is the mind itself. Once we engage with our own mind as we would a piano or a guitar, anything is possible because our minds are truly extraordinary. We are so narrow in the way we use our minds because we limit them to a little set of categories we've learned during our upbringing and education. As we engage with our minds without those categories, realms open that we otherwise had no idea were there. It's literally infinite. And so there is a huge potentiality we all carry. It is the potentiality of being a human being.
You know, I'm sure we can go on for so much longer. I have so many, you know, random kind of small specific questions, but I really enjoyed this conversation and thank you for really espousing these truths. And as someone who has been who is going to go through this 14-week journey as a musician, I cannot stop making the connections between the two. So this has been such an enlightening conversation for me as a human, but also as someone who wants to empower the arts and our humanity and all of that. So thank you for your time today, Richard.
Feel free to be in touch anytime, honestly. Delightful to talk to you.
Thank you for tuning in. Listeners are welcome to connect with me over Instagram and LinkedIn. You just have to search my name, and I love to hear from you. If you'd like to learn more about my work as a coach and artist, please visit www.robertkwanghome.com.